Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey, 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 everybody. Hello, friends. We have a couple of quick Art History Babes Nation updates for you.
What's going on over here in our world?
First off, we have a new featured artist.
Zach Clark.
You might recognize
him from some of our previous episodes, such as Carita Kent or Albrecht Dürer.
And our upcoming episode on Robert Rauschenberg as
Which
well.
Which is going to be great.
It's going to be
just
doozy.
As rambly and crazy as the first one. So we're officially blaming that on Zach.
Yeah. But you've maybe heard him before on the show. He's a friend of ours and he's an artist, a printmaker, and he is our featured artist. And he has created a beautiful print set called Confabulation is a River in California. And it is available for purchase on the Art History Babes website. It's a really interesting print set and just a really interesting concept. And if you want to learn about it, learn about the story behind it, and learn about Zach and his process and his life as an artist, you can head over to our YouTube channel and watch our featured artist video.
Because we're on YouTube now, guys. We got quite a few videos already.
We're on YouTube. We're just expanding the content.
You can see our faces now.
Yeah.
Our faces are going to match our mouths. Watch the words come out.
It's pretty great.
It's cool.
It's a pretty cool thing. So we have a handful of videos up right now, and we're going to keep making them and keep churning them out for you guys. So be sure to check out the YouTube, subscribe and like and hit that little bell so you get notifications when we put content out there. But yeah, so just some fun, exciting things. What else is going on? Do we have other exciting things to talk about?
We're going to have new merch coming out soon.
Oh yeah, merch.
Summer merch is coming soon, which means spring merch is going to be going. So if there's anything that you've been thinking about getting and haven't pulled the trigger, now might be the time.
So head over to arthistorybabes.com, check out our merch, check out our featured artist, check out all of our stuff that we're working on for you lovely people and for you lovely patrons. Shout out to all of our patrons.
We love you so much.
patreon.com/arthistorybabes. You guys make it possible, so thank you. You're all amazing. And let's get to the show.
From Cabernet to Mornay, they're here to slay the Art History Babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Ginny.
I'm Jen.
And we are the Art History Babes.
Art History Babe work weekend.
We're all together.
I love when this happens.
Working together on a weekend.
Working together on a weekend.
Yeah, it's work/bender/sleepover/.
It's been good.
I've been
having a great time.
Me too.
I don't even know. Like, I'd be doing laundry right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
This is great.
I'd be like probably watching all the speeches from the March for Our Lives and like crying tears of sadness and hope and being, which I did yesterday, so I'd just be doing the same thing today.
Just be doing more of that.
Yeah, but it's so amazing.
It is.
It's so incredible, like there was an 11-year-old that got up, and I was just like, you are smarter than I am now, and you are more eloquent, and this is the future.
Yeah.
That makes me feel good, though.
I
want to see smart 11-year-olds.
Right.
Yeah. All of this has, like, made me feel a lot more hopeful than I've felt in, like, a while.
Right. It feels good. And I think this particular issue is... For so long, it's been at such a standstill, mm-hmm. and now people are finally being like, no, like, mm-hmm. we're done, and mm-hmm. and I feel like there's a shift, you know, just yeah. a huge shift with this yeah. argument happening, which is so great, because it has yeah. hit a brick wall for so long, right. way too long.
Yeah. Right. I just heard that L.L. Bean came out saying that they will no longer sell guns, and I said, what?
Yeah, I saw the Dick's Sporting Goods.
I didn't know that L.L. Bean sold guns.
Exactly.
Where have I been?
yeah. That would have been my reaction.
Yeah, that was my reaction.
L.L. Bean sells guns?
Yeah, I thought they just sold rain boots.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. I thought it was just clothing for sophisticated, like, 40-year-old men. Mm. And I now...
Who like to go glamping.
Right. So
who like to look like they
right
go glamping.
So you know learn something new every day, but you know what, good on you, totally. L.L. Bean totally. And Dick's Sporting Goods,
mm-hmm. yeah. That was a good one.
Great I think that you would be surprised where you can buy guns anywhere.
I know it's
unreal.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know what, I tend not to hope for anything really, but I do hope that
the optimism
this is
just oozing out of you.
I have none, but I really do hope that this is really like the beginning of right. like a real change, because this is insane. Like it's unreal.
It's just common sense. Like mm-hmm. there is no reason that someone can't buy a fucking can of beer until they're 21, but they can buy like a
semi-automatic weapon.
It's insane.
And there are lots of gun owners out there, like reasonable gun right. owners, that understand that. They're like, right. hey, if this isn't going to affect me, because I'm right. still going to be able to purchase a gun, like, this is just smart.
I remember the feeling of realizing that, like, this conversation is not talking about, like, taking away gun owners' rights and being like, so what? What is happening? Yeah. Like, I remember that vivid moment of being like, okay, then what's the conversation? It shouldn't be.
I remember from like 2 years ago, Barack Obama did like a town hall, and you should YouTube it. It's really great. He is so clear, mm-hmm. like so clear, because someone asks him about like taking away gun rights, and he's like so crystal clear, like, that is not what is happening here.
No.
Like explaining exactly what the situation is, and that, you know, common sense gun regulation is, it has nothing to do with taking away people's
exactly.
rights, you know.
And you get people that are so like up in arms about their Second Amendment rights, and like, oh, it's an assault on
up in
right.
arms.
They're literally up in arms. I know.
Shit, I didn't even think about that, but I'll pretend that I did think about it, even though I just told you all that I didn't think about it when I said
we'll
that.
Just edit that part out.
Yeah, just edit it out, make me sound flawless. But the thing about that, too, is, like, when the Constitution was written and when people, they were writing the Second Amendment, like, no one could fucking even imagine what kind of guns would later be developed.
Yeah, right?
You know, back like then, you had a musket and you had to, you know, shove the powder in
there's
it.
There's another video.
Thing.
They're like, who even wants this?
I know.
There's a video where they do that. It's, like, in a public space, and they essentially reenact what a like quote unquote mass shooting would be like if you were using guns like they had back when the Second Amendment was written. And it's ridiculous, like, because it takes it forever and everyone's like gone, but like it's just like a ridiculous thing because it would not work, you know.
So
it's the refusal to understand we live in a completely different time
right
than when that was written. And also the Constitution has what we call amendments, like it's been amended before,
like the second one.
Right,
dude,
like, kind of like that.
We can amend things when things change.
It's like, just crazy. It's like that maluse of history where you like intentionally forget obstruct certain things from history to serve your own purpose, but then you also just like clutch on to these things where it's like, well, it's part of our history.
Right,
but like,
it's so choosy.
Slaves were, you know, manual laborers, and it's like, what the fuck?
What are you talking about? it's interesting the different ways people use history for mm-hmm. agendas. Mm-hmm. And I think it also has some interesting ties to human perception, because
totally.
It's partially the way you perceive the
right.
situation
right.
too. Anyways, we support
all y'all.
I'm so proud of all of you. If any of you like young people are listening to this who like went out in March and have like been doing things at school, I'm so impressed.
For real.
It's so cool.
You're the best
around. Nothing's ever gonna
bring you down. All right, before we get into today's episode, just want to give a quick shout out to our producer level patron, Sarah Sawatchka Dalton. Is producer level helping the art history babes out. Thank you so much, Sarah.
We love you, Sarah.
Bless thee, thank thee.
Yes, we very much appreciate it. If you want to become a patron at any level, just head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes.
We have a really cute new photo up. We're looking real good.
Looking real good in that photo. But yeah, there's multiple levels, different perks, and you too can be a producer if you so wish. Yes. So thank you so much, Sarah. We appreciate you. On today's episode, we are talking about such a fun topic. I'm so excited about this. We are discussing synesthesia.
I have a really hard time saying it.
I think it's a hard word.
Me too.
Synesthesia.
Synesthesia.
There's a song where it's called synesthesia, but they pronounce it like synesthesia, and I'm like, I don't think that's right, but whatever.
Mm-hmm. Maybe for rhyming purposes.
Yeah, I think it's for the
you're
art.
Probably right.
But I could be wrong. Who knows? I don't know. I think it's synesthesia.
Synesthesia
though.
Sounds right. Mm-hmm. And for the purposes of
synesthesia, amnesia.
Right.
The older I get,
you don't say amnesia.
Amnesia.
Maybe some people do though. The older I get, the less like particular I'm getting about pronunciation, because I'm like, there are English words that between different English speaking countries are pronounced so different that I'm like, I mean, if you're like butchering someone's name in an offensive way, that's not.
It's also
cool,
people say schedule.
Yeah, right? Exactly. There's like so many little variations that I'm like, meh.
But the fun thing about American English, though, is like a lot of those differences, at least between us and the British, were just intentional to be we're different from the British. Like,
hold
we just
up.
Like intentionally.
We're going to spell schedule. Color without the U.
Exactly.
I'm not trying to go on a tangent, but.
But I'm going to go on a tangent.
I'm going to. No, I heard that the modern day British accent is like a relatively new thing, and that British people, when they came over to the U.S., you know, before it was the U.S., would have had like an entirely different accent. Like it didn't sound like it sounds today.
I mean, that makes sense. We don't sound like our American.
That's so true.
All you need to do is watch The Witch and you're like, whoa,
I was about to say,
I can't understand anything.
I don't know what they're saying. I watched,
still haven't English seen that town. Movie.
No, I don't.
I think there probably has been, because on both sides, that was a very, like, the Americans and the British were trying to, like, make their language uniquely their own. I think we probably both just moved in those directions. And if the British have upped their accent, like, that wouldn't surprise me. So in case you don't know what synesthesia is, it is a neurological phenomenon in which two or more senses overlap. So the example that's heard most commonly is people that see music as colors. So when they hear music, they actually, you know, see in their mind's eye, they see different colors moving. They oftentimes associate very specific colors with certain musical notes. You know,
it's so cool.
There's a very clear connection. So it's not just like random colors or anything. Like there's a specific certain music, certain sounds can trigger colors. They can also trigger shapes. Mm-hmm. They can trigger all kinds of different effects. There are many, many ways synesthesia manifests. People often associate colors with tastes. So like taste something like this tastes blue. Some people can feel voices, like they can have a tactile response to certain voices. For some people, foods taste like colors. Sounds of all kinds can trigger different kinds of visuals. Some people it is color, some people it's shapes. What are known as graphemes are when letters and numbers have specific colors like associated with them, or even personalities. So people will be like, the number 9 is like a
vixen.
Yeah, a vixen, exactly. Or like they
ooh,
right?
Whoa.
I know, isn't that interesting? What happens a lot with this, with graphemes, is
almost like personal color codes. Mm. So people will, like, every letter of the alphabet, like, just has naturally a color associated with it.
Yeah.
And there's actually this story. So recently they did a Science Friday episode where they talked about synesthesia and some new research that's being done on synesthesia. It actually just happened like last week. And they were telling a story about someone that works for Science Friday that has synesthesia. And she says she, like, gets in trouble when giving people directions for, like, the MTA, mm-hmm. For, like, public transportation, because for her, because you know how, like, all the lines are color-coded, yeah. like blue line, yeah, red yeah. line, whatever. For her, the lines have different color associations.
Mm-hmm.
So she, like, associates one line of public transportation with a different color than it's actually color coded. So she's created her own color code because of yeah. her synesthesia.
Yeah.
So if she tells you to take the blue line, it's probably something different That's from so what it actually
interesting.
Is.
Interesting. Yeah. And now I'm curious about, remember in color theory, how we talked about like all the people in the world who have a fourth cone in their eye
oh, yeah, yeah.
are women
mm-hmm.
and that women tend to be able to see more colors than men.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there is a gender association with synesthesia or oh, like yeah, with certain types of synesthesia or if it's kind of just across the board.
Mm. For sure. There's definitely, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more, but they are saying that there is something hereditary about it, that there is a
right.
gene.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that they've done any, like, you know, gender research, mm-hmm. but that would be interesting to look at. Also, just, like, I know color blindness is, like, yeah. in men.
Yeah.
Like.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking yeah. is, like, some of these things they can trace to gender and not, like, it's mutually exclusive necessarily, but there are correlations.
The DNA, mm-hmm. yeah, like, connection. Let's see. Other examples. Phonemes are when words are associated with something else. So for some people, like college tastes like sausage, like they taste sausage.
What?
Yeah. Wait. So any word with like an edge sound tastes like sausage.
So if I say the word sausage, they taste sausage.
Well, yeah, but that's not weird. like associating the taste of sausage with the word sausage.
But then also, like, do they associate like hearing the word or yeah. when they say it? Like, does it have to be happening in their mouth mm-hmm. or is it like even just hearing it?
I think it's hearing it okay. too. I think it's because it's the association of the word. It's the connecting yeah. the word to
That'd
a,
be so distracting to a if sense you were response. Tasting different things all the time while yeah. people were dogging
Especially
you.
When you're like, you know, I guess you get a used senior to it. In high school and everyone's like, where are you going to go to college? You decide on what college you're going to? When you start college, what's your major in college?
You're just like,
you just grow to hate sausage.
I hate sausage at that point.
So I think that, yeah, that one's a pretty common one where people have triggers with words. So which makes perfect sense because the way our brain works is like you hear a word and right. we associate meaning
right.
with it.
Right.
There's just a crossover with a sense for these same people. So while their brain is pulling their knowledge of the word college, you know, mm-hmm. why their brain is pulling out college means this, mm-hmm. it's also just pulling out this sense response that yeah. has connected to that neuron
yeah.
that represents the word college.
Right.
So it's just like this deeper experience of that word. Synesthesia is considered a trait, not a disorder.
I was about to ask.
It is not like it isn't considered something that is that impacts your life in a negative way. In
right.
fact, most people consider it like enhancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it,
I would.
It helps memory for very obvious reasons because you have stronger connections to mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. If you know just like about basic kind of like memory and neuroscience, is the more connections you have to any one idea, faster your recall is
mm-hmm.
because you've created connections. So that's why it's actually really smart when you're studying to connect your information to novel things, mm-hmm. like not just the information that you need, but to make novel connections because yeah. then it's easier to recall the information.
Did you ever listen to that guy who's like, I don't know if he has like the best memory or he's famous for how well he remembers
yes,
things
yeah.
and he talks about how he remembers
oh,
things.
The memory palace.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he
yes,
walks
yes.
through
yes.
this fictional place space yeah. in his head and he's like describing to you what he's visualizing
yeah.
and it's and there's like numbers and colors and storylines all involved
totally.
And it's fascinating. And I was like, I could never do that, but I'm so amazed by you.
Yeah. Totally. He creates a whole world so yeah. he can memorize stuff and he's like a memory world champion.
Yeah. That's yeah. It was some obscure title. Or
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
recognition.
So just, I mean, for all those out there that are like studying for shit right now, just a little tip, trick, try and create novel connections for your information. Mm-hmm. Nice. But essentially, so people with synesthesia tend to have better memories because they have these very intense connections, mm-hmm. like actual physical sensual connections. So they can, you know, recall that information better. There is also some issues that come with it. Like they're discovering in the research that people with synesthesia do sometimes have a problem in educational settings because there's a contradiction between what their brains are doing and the common curriculum.
Yeah.
Like, for example, for some people, like the number 3 will be associated with like blue and the number 4 will be associated with red, but 7 isn't purple. So it messes with, yeah. Or like so the colors and the numbers don't work correctly. Yeah, or so it can mess with.
Sure. And there's no like exact science to it, right? It's just whatever associations their brains are making. So you can't be like, this color is this letter to people with synesthesia or whatever.
There's not necessarily anything objective or logical about it. I mean, for some, I think the example
makes me like it more.
I know, right? I think some examples, like the college tasting like sausage, makes more sense to me, because the word sausage does elicit like a bit of a taste response. I think as just being a human, if you think about it, you start to taste sausage, you know. So the idea that a word that sounds like sausage tastes like sausage, that makes more logical sense to me.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of different ways this manifests, and there isn't necessarily a logical, you know, reason to it.
Yeah.
Oh, also, in terms of synesthesia, to some degree, we all kind of have it. We just don't have it in like the diagnosable sense. So basically, people with synesthesia, it is a heightened version of something that everyone's brain does,
mm-hmm.
because all of our senses map to one another to some degree. All of us have crossing of our senses that happens. For example, like that's why when we use the term like sweet person, we understand that you're associating a flavor, you're associating sweet to a person, but we understand that, you know, just like inherently
to mean like pleasurable.
Exactly. So it's an example of associating a word, a flavor with a word, and like, so that's an example of just like our senses mapping to one another. But to someone with synesthesia, you know, that could be taken to a higher level, to where they feel sugar, like they taste sugar, or or it could be something, or it could be associated to a color as well or something. So it's basically just taking that and heightening it even further. Some famous people with synesthesia, there's quite a few of them. David Hockney.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, David Hockney. Billy Joel. Lady Gaga. Composer Vladimir Nabokov.
Oh, he was a writer. He wrote Lolita.
Who was I thinking was the... I thought I...
Lolites.
Vladimir Nabokov, though, was...
Who was the composer? I think I forgot to write.
A synesthete.
It's interesting, though, that he was.
Nabokov?
Mm-hmm.
You know what's... When I found out about that, I was like, wow, that makes a lot of sense, because just his writing style is so sensual.
Yeah.
Not because of his, like... you know, lusting, thematic like elements, but just
lusting after a young girl.
But just like in the way he writes, like I get that.
Tori Amos, Vasily Kandinsky, who Jen's gonna talk about a bit, Duke Ellington, Pharrell Williams.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, because I might be remembering this incorrectly, but doesn't Questlove have it? Didn't he say that in a piece of work?
I think he does. Yeah. I think he said he does have synesthesia. Which
I think so.
I think so too. I'm pretty sure. I think we talked about that. Yeah, it's music and color for him.
Oh, cool.
Because we were talking about Eve Klein.
Yes. It was in Abby Jacobson's piece of work.
Questlove out there hearing.
Because I know when we heard that, we were like, of course he does.
Yeah. Because he's just like the coolest person. Van Gogh was thought to have it. Apparently, there's this anecdote that during piano lessons, he would associate notes with colors. And his piano teacher took this as a sign that he was insane and asked him to leave.
That Dutch bitch.
Man.
Van Gogh.
Just every time I find out something new about him, it's just sad. and unfair.
It's always sad.
And I'm just like, oh.
It just pushes like the Van Gogh arrow that's already in my heart. Yeah. Just in like just a, deeper. A centimeter deeper. Yeah. Just like each thing I hear is like,
like, oh, Van Gogh.
So sad.
Just buddy. Really quickly though, to jump back to Questlove. In 2016, The Roots came out with a song called Bittersweet, which is meant to harness synesthesia.
What? Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
We should listen to that.
Yeah, we should listen to that after this. The Roots.
Love it.
I know.
So great. So some of the science behind this, as I said, there's a newer episode of Science Friday about it. So go check that out. The scientific understanding of this is quite limited, but many people in the neuroscience community are currently working on it, including Amanda Tilot and Ed Hubbard. So approximately 4% of the world population has synesthesia in some form or another. There is evidence that it's hereditary. They're still kind of working that out, but they do see a difference in a remarkable difference in genes of people with synesthesia. And they also see a connection in families. So if like parents and kids having it is pretty common. The genes involving how neurons connect to one another are overrepresented in people that have synesthesia. So like they have more genes that affect the way neurons connect to one another, which makes sense. And these genes predispose the brain to make these extra connections. So there's also a theory that we all have synesthesia as babies.
Oh.
And they've done a study on this, and the evidence suggests that that could be true, that, you know, we do things like associate colors with shapes and make these overlapping connections as babies, but that as we grow, a person that doesn't have synesthesia, those connections fade away.
They get replaced by like things that were taught, like societally maybe. Does that seem like...
I don't know that they get replaced by things that were taught. I think it's just because that's the way the brain works is that over time, connections that don't serve you get removed because it keeps the functioning of the brain higher. And I think it's just for people with synesthesia, their connections are just stronger for some reason. So those stick around, which goes back to their memories just being stronger, you know?
Right.
I think it might just be, you know, when we're babies, we're making sense of those basic things and making sense of our senses. So it would make sense.
Lots of sense going on.
Yeah, it would make sense that that we would have those overlapping associations because we're learning how to map out the world.
I wonder how they have been able to discover that babies have synesthesia.
They did a experiment where they would show babies like colors repeatedly and to see how long it took before they'd get bored, you know, because babies are always about like stimuli. And so they would like show a color repeatedly, you know, to see how long it would take before they get bored. I think the color was red. And then they created an association between shapes and colors. And then they would find that like the amount of time that it took for a baby to get bored with red was like the same amount of time it took to get bored with a triangle or something. Or they associated, or it wasn't the same amount of time. It was, they associated colors with shapes. And then if a baby was bored with a certain color, they would also be bored with the corresponding shape or something like that.
Oh, so
does that make sense?
It would register the same to them.
So I mean, that's kind of a vague way, but that was my understanding of it. So it suggested that there was a connection between the shape and the color. And I think they're, you know, going to do more research on that as well. Also, another big question, can you learn synesthesia? And the answer, at least that Ed Hubbard gave, is kind of, as I said there, it's hereditary. And like there are people that just experience it and experience it super intensely. Yeah. Like for some people, it's distracting sometimes, you know? Like one woman said, like she can't really listen to music in the car because it distracts her from driving. So it can be really intense for a lot of people. But as far as learning it goes, you can always improve connections in your brain, and you can do exercises that kind of are synesthetic in nature, like that are, you know, creating associations between like music and color. And that's why if you have like an artist that like, you know, is also a musician, you know, you're gonna have overlapping of those kind of neurons. And so you can foster it to a certain degree, but it has to be a little more induced. And some people have successfully done that to where now their brain does create colors when they listen to music, but it's not the same, like it's more induced. It's not just something that happens to them. You know what I mean? It's like a trait they they've fostered, that they've practiced. So kind of, if you want to create these kind of connections between your senses, like, you can actively do that to some degree. Mm-hmm. Also, they're currently doing a study involving synesthesia. So if any of our listeners have synesthesia of any kind, you can participate from anywhere in the world. It's a voluntary study.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So head over to www.mpi.nl/synesthesia. We'll put a link in the show notes too. And they actually have quizzes too, if you're not sure if you have synesthesia.
Nice.
So you can like take some quizzes, play around, and perfect. And then you can volunteer to be a part of this cool study. So that's what I got on the science of synesthesia.
Nice.
I think before we dive into some of our artistic examples, we should take a quick break.
Cute.
We'll be right back. And we're back. Gonna talk about some famous examples, or well, one of my favorite famous examples by the man's name, Vasily Kandinsky. Vasily Kandinsky was in what happened
by the man's name.
Can I start
Vasily
over?
Kandinsky by the man's name.
So you guys would catch that. I'm starting over. Ooh. Vasily Kandinsky.
God damn it. Guys.
It's your fault.
Sorry, okay. All right.
Okay. Vasily Kandinsky, he was an artist, and he was one of the not pioneers, but he really believed that abstraction was a truer art form. And so a lot of his abstract work, though, is unique in the sense that his synesthesia really comes through. So he had synesthesia. For him, music and color were inextricably tied to one another. This relationship was very clear for Kandinsky, so much that he did associate every note with an exact hue. He once said that the sound of colors is so definite that it would be hard to find anyone who would express bright yellow with bass notes or dark lake with treble.
Obviously.
I mean,
yeah. Come on.
Duh. In fact, it was after having an unusually visual response to a performance of Wagner's composition Lohengrin at the Bolshoi Theater that he abandoned his career, his law career, to study painting at the prestigious Munich Academy of Fine Arts.
I didn't know that.
I know.
Which makes sense.
I didn't either.
Now I'm like wanting to talk to my dad because he loves Kandinsky, and dude, I wonder if he knows that because my dad's a lawyer for all of you listeners. Hey, Dad. You're probably listening to this.
He's a lawyer and an artsy man.
He is an artsy man.
He wears a turtleneck better than anyone.
Yep. And he kind of looks like Anderson Cooper.
He does kind of look like Anderson Cooper. He gets that a lot. And he has a huge Kandinsky print in his house. And I still want to do a segment somehow related to the podcast where we take my 5-year-old brother and talk about the Kandinsky with him and see his perspective.
That would be great.
I really want to do that.
I would love to do that. Right? And bless Felix. And Felix, if you're listening, have you considered studying painting?
He used to be quite the artist when he was younger. Wow. So.
Later on, Kandinsky would describe this as a life-changing experience. And he said, "I saw all my colors in spirit before my eyes. Wild, almost crazy lines were sketched in front of me." Mm-hmm. That is so cool. Mm-hmm. Just to feel like you're always tripping balls, like, right? You know, and all you gotta do is hear some like pretty, you know, compelling music.
There was, when Corey was saying like, can you teach yourself synesthesia, there was a part of me that was like, there's probably a drug that can.
Oh yeah. It's called acid.
For real. But the thing is, though, what's interesting is most people's synesthesia, like, they don't feel that way at all because
that's all they've known.
Very similar to colorblind people, until, for a lot of them, until someone says like, that's not the way things are, people are like, what?
Like, like Winston and New Girl.
Yes,
and he's
yes.
like, these are my favorite green shoes, and they're like, those are brown.
Wow.
Yeah, very much so. A lot of times people, you know, just assume that their associations with like music and color is what everyone associates, and so they'll have a moment of like someone not knowing what the fuck they're talking about or something before right. they realize like, oh, this is like a different thing.
Yeah, totally.
That's why originally I was going to ask if synesthesia is considered like a disability mm-hmm. because I could see it causing problems. Like in Kandinsky's case, it was quite the asset to his art career. Mm-hmm. Kandinsky gave many of his paintings musical titles such as composition or improvisation. This is something that I think is really common now. Well, like, you know,
it was, yeah. I mean, it was common before Kandinsky.
Right.
Like,
right.
What's his face? The flying rocket.
Sergeant. No, not
the Sergeant. Flying rocket.
The night.
Evel Knievel?
No.
the father of modernism.
Yeah, the father of modernism.
Flying rocket.
Yeah.
It's called Night Something.
Yeah,
but
the
it
rocket.
Looks, it looks like a, yeah.
You know, I studied Baroque art, so I don't,
we've talked I don't about him on the podcast.
The father of modernism.
Rocket John. Man. Elton John.
It's definitely Elton John.
James yes. Abbott McNeil Whistler, Whistler, Nocturne in Black and Gold, also known as The Falling Rocket.
There we go.
Hold up. Whistler is the father of modernism?
No, yeah, this painting.
This painting was a big deal
okay.
like a, in modernism because we should actually do like a whole episode on oh, this painting, yeah. to be honest.
It looks amazing.
Oh, it's a beautiful
it's
painting.
Really beautiful.
But he made it and it went to court actually mm-hmm. because people are like, what the fuck is this shit? Because it's super wow. abstract.
Well, yeah. it was
court.
Someone, yeah. Well, someone was talking bad about it, like criticizing uh-huh. it. And then it was a whole, it was like a slander case.
Oh. Weird.
Where it was like, is it slanderous to say this or is it not art? Wasn't that kind of the premise?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know anything about this. I've
it's
never
me neither.
Heard
so interesting.
About this.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's a very important case in just like the turn into modernism yeah. because
wow.
the counter argument was that he's not creating art because it's
too abstract.
Too abstract. Oh. Yeah. And that was like the legitimate legal argument yeah. against it. But anyways, that's all an entirely different thing that we will talk about some other time.
Well, that's okay. I mean, the point being that I don't know, maybe Whistler thought similar ideas about color and music. Although Kandinsky wasn't the first and certainly wasn't the last to give his paintings musical titles, I believe that for him it was really appropriate and he really did think in this musical way when he was painting. Kandinsky would also create a piece that was conceived for the theater. It was a experimental performance-based expression of synesthesia called The Yellow Sound. Mm. He composed a few of these theater pieces, but The Yellow Sound is the most famous, and it utilized original musical scores, lighting, and various media to explore prevalent color theories of the time. So The Yellow Sound, or in German, Der Gelbe Klang, is an experimental theater piece originated by Kandinsky in 1909. It was the earliest and the most influential of four color tone dramas that Kandinsky conceived for theater between 1909 and 1914. The others were titled The Green Sound, Black and White, and Violet. Kandinsky's pieces were part of this larger trend of the era that addressed color theory and synesthesia in works that blended multiple art forms and media. Other works, such as one called Prometheus by Scriabin, 1910, is arguably the best known. And these works would utilize lighting and other innovations to extend the normal range of artistic expression. So early 20th century, real experimental stuff. And Kandinsky was so fascinated by these ideas that he actually would publish a book on his own theory on color and synesthesia. Returning quickly just to his opera, because it was a one-act opera, The Yellow Sound. There was no dialogue or conventional plot. It was divided into six pictures. There was a child in white and an adult performer in black representing life and death. Other figures were costumed in single colors, including five intensely yellow giants, or people as large as possible. And
It was a person as large as possible.
Find someone as large as possible.
I will take an extra large person.
And also vague red creatures, somewhat suggesting birds. Kandinsky sadly never saw the yellow sound performed during his lifetime. He and his colleagues in a group called Der Blue Reiter, the Blue Reiter.
We should do an episode on them.
I would love, including Franz Marc, August Mack, and Alfred Kuban worked intensively on a planned 1914 Munich production, but it was canceled by the outbreak of World War One.
Yeah.
Funny how that just kind of gets in the way, you know? Kandinsky believed that color had the ability to put viewers in touch with their spiritual selves. He believed that yellow could be very disturbing. Blue awakened the highest spiritual aspirations. Yeah. We will touch on the Blue Reiter again. I think it'd be really fun to do an episode on that. But really quick, this whole group were just an informal sort of group of intellectuals that had similar philosophical ideas, focused on spirituality, symbolism, these issues mainly in art. Many of their members, especially Kandinsky, really truly believed that abstraction was this pathway to utopia, a new spiritual age. And so they chose the color blue as part of their name because it was considered to be the color of transcendence and spirituality.
Yeah, I think they came up very briefly in our ABEX episode.
Yes, oh, totally. We did talk
and
about
when,
them.
Even back when we did color theory and we I talked about blue. Yeah. I might have mentioned them, but I actually don't know if I did.
I don't know if you did, but...
But I remember it at the very least thinking like, oh shit, how could I have like not brought them up? But they deserve their like own full episode at a certain point because blue is like, it just has that association of like kind of spiritual and something somewhat intangible that is really interesting.
What's that song? Blue is the most human color.
I don't know.
It's not like a well-known song, but it's like a song I liked when I was younger. And the whole thing is like, blue is the most human color. And I was like, wow. I didn't even know why, but I was like, blue. That really struck me. I was like, yes, it is. Yes.
So the studies that he did for his final, the final painting, which was Composition 7, painted in 1913. He did many studies for this work. And so many of the studies originated in these like biblical themes of transformation and the last judgment and really reflecting Kandinsky's search for something moving away from the material world into a divine realm. He emphasized these ideas in his painting, and so color was some sort of vehicle for Kandinsky's search for this like divine in art towards some sort of utopic future. So, you know, let's just put this in context to early 20th century. Everyone's trying to create a utopia. We just wrapped up an episode on a BB on the Bauhaus. Check that one out.
We're about to do impressionism ideas, which there's some in that too. Totally.
Utopia, man, they were like, the world is changing really fast. We need answers.
There's so many good like utopian novels from that time frame too.
Absolutely.
They were just trying to figure it all out. And like now, frantically trying to
what's
like
what's happening.
I love, and now we've moved to dystopia. Now we're obsessed with like a dystopia. For and sure. Like what's that gonna look like, because the utopia's not happening. We tried, it's not.
And then postmodernism happened and we were like
nah.
Actually, I feel like, I think I've talked about this before, but I think we're in a place, because we are definitely concerned with the dystopia, like undoubtedly that's very present, but I also think there is a very hopeful utopian like thread that runs through our weird like postmodern cynicism, you know what I mean? I feel like we found this weird place between cynical and hopeful right now. Like,
I think when you say we, I would define myself as a person.
I mean, just like societally, like
or
I think,
like liberal-minded society. I feel like more.
I mean, I guess I'm thinking in terms of like there was postmodernism, and now we're in a different phase that is came from the postmodern and the cynicism of the postmodern, and that's still there, but now we're being a little more hopeful and optimistic and like trying to kind of trying to reach for a utopia, but in a different way.
But yeah, the reason I guess I'm like clarifying, the reason I'm clarifying liberal is because it's like the idea of like trying to save the planet and do things like this. And then I feel like there's also another side of that where people who just don't care are more like, let's watch it all burn. Like,
yeah,
I'm only going to be here for 50 more years. So like, let's just let it all crumble. And it's sad.
Up, yeah, totally. And they're like straight up people, especially, I mean, I'm just mainly speaking of America, but there are a lot of people in this country that think that like the world is going to end and that the apocalypse is upon us. So they're like, well,
I totally agree. Yeah. But I also feel like that's been all of history. People that's always true. Thought the apocalypse was coming at like every moment.
That's true.
There are people that were like, it's coming. Yeah. Like Jesus is coming back. It's coming right now.
It didn't happen on that day that I said, well, okay, I changed
my predictions were wrong. I researched the sacred texts and actually
it's 3 years from that day. Yeah. So
I think that's just manifestation of fear in humans throughout all of time. It's like, well, the world's ending. Like, and I mean, they're not wrong because it will end someday, but
right.
You know, what's wild is I feel that with the onset of the Industrial Revolution and modernity and this specific moment in time in late 19th, early 20th century where everything was changing so fast, if someone were to say this is the beginning of the apocalypse, I don't think they would be wrong, because look where we are now. We're about to blow ourselves up. That's just facts.
I don't know that that's facts.
It's facts.
I think it's possible, but I do. I think it's similar. I think we're always on the edge of the apocalypse. You know what I mean?
I'm placing my bet now. We're going to blow ourselves up in the next 100 years.
I read Fahrenheit 451.
That's such a good book. That book, man.
I had never read it, actually.
It's rough.
I didn't have a class. I feel like a lot of people read it at a certain age in school. My teacher, none of my teachers ever had me read it. So I just read it recently, and it's a good book to read right now.
Yeah, it's a great book.
It's crazy how things from... It's all cyclical, like these cultural works, you know, like they'll be very, very relevant in the period that they're made. And then they're kind of like, and then there's like a resurgence of it, how everything sort of circles back around in this crazy way where you can read things or watch things or see art or whatever that's from decades ago. And yet in the context that you're reading, it can be very relevant, almost like prophetic, where it's like, how did they know?
It felt like it could be a Black Mirror episode. Honestly, that's what I kept thinking was like, this is like the predecessor to Black Mirror. But
I agree. I think history is incredibly cyclical. Yes. Like,
absolutely.
Like, undeniably cyclical. You
there's
always
some crazy intricate pattern.
Oh yeah, that and you're always coming back and revisiting things that weren't fully figured out.
You know what
out.
It is because this is really a simulation, and
right?
the aliens controlling our lives are just running a code.
That's the most likely scenario, I think, is we're just like in a video game.
We're all just Sims.
Yeah, we're just Sims.
Go see our... All right, is it out yet, though?
No, not yet, but we have a hot takes conspiracy theories episode where we discuss simulation theory. Not that that's even a conspiracy theory. That's just like a legitimate theory.
I feel like our listeners are slowly but surely observing our like existential like crisis meltdown over like this last year. Like, we're out of school and what's going on?
What if someone writes their thesis on like observing the art history babe's evolution and like like they just like observe us and
by like our last episode we're just like, nothing matters. We're all gonna die.
So back to synesthesia.
I don't feel that way.
No, Corey is like adamant. Corey will never feel that way.
Well, I don't know. I definitely have the existential crises, but I don't think it's that. I don't think it's that scary or dire, I guess, is what I'm saying. I don't know, and that's also like why I like art, is because it doesn't make me feel like it's scary and we're all gonna die.
I know, I'm just like there's meaning.
Exactly
hope and there's meaning.
Did you have more to say about our pal Kandinsky, Jen?
No, I just I think that he's great.
And, he's great.
I just want to,
speaking of art that makes you feel hopeful and like there's meaning, I have always felt that way about Kandinsky.
Agreed.
I do think there's something very spiritual about his work, and I love colors, so yeah. it it's just
I've never looked at a Kandinsky and felt like I've always just felt like
right, it's really nice,
like energized,
interesting, and Kandinsky's great. Oh, I love him. Let's take another quick break and we'll be right back. We're back, people.
We're back. Oh.
And we are talking about synesthesia among many other things.
Many other important
Okay. Here's what's going on. I'm going to explain it to our listeners and to ourselves. This is a very, like, heady topic.
It is.
It's really, like,
conceptual.
Just, yeah, it's like,
it's easy to jump.
Conceptual, and it's, you know, we're talking about
perception, the doors of perception.
Perception, our senses, how they can get crossed in the ether of our brain network of neurons. So it's some heavy shit.
So that, yeah, that relates to spirituality really quick, which relates to everything
existentialism,
else.
Existentialism, the destruction of mankind. So we're on topic, okay?
We are. I think our conversations definitely make sense to us, but let's try and steer us a little more. Like,
you know what, dude?
Synesthesia.
This is the art. And
so here we go. On to another path of synesthesia.
You're saying it was like a little bit of an Italian
that
I like.
Oh.
Just in the way you're like,
synesthesia.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Just the end. You're like, oh,
I love allora. When I love when Ginny says things in an Italian way.
Okay. So I was looking up, trying to look up more artists like Kandinsky who more than likely had or have synesthesia. And I came across a contemporary artist named Melissa McCracken, who is a 26-year-old artist from Missouri who processes songs as colors. And the specific branch of synesthesia that she has is chromesthesia. God, these words.
That's
are
what
so
Van
hard.
Gogh had.
Okay.
Yes.
Chromesthesia.
So what is that?
So it's seeing sounds as colors.
So Kandinsky then would have also experienced this. Okay.
It's one of the more common.
Right.
I could see that especially for visual artists.
Totally. Yeah. So it's what a lot of musical artists and visual artists have.
Nice.
So for her, color floats in her vision, but according to her, it isn't obtrusive or it doesn't have any kind of hallucinogenic quality. And she was born with this. You know, she thought it was very common and that everyone had it until she was 16. And this is an interview from a Vice Broadly article where she said she was trying to pick out a ringtone and her phone was blue. And she was talking to her friend. She was like, I want to pick a ringtone that's orange because blue and orange are complementary colors. And her friend was like, what are you talking about?
What?
So she didn't even know that she was exceptional in that way until she was a teenager. So she is an artist and began sort of painting memories and linking those memories to specific songs that triggered different parts of her life, like really noteworthy periods in her life. And then from there, she began painting some of her favorite songs. And now she even paints songs by commission. So if you get in touch with her and you say, I love this song, can you paint it? She doesn't necessarily do all of them. If it's one that doesn't resonate with her a lot or there's just not enough variety to get like a lot of colors or a strong composition, she will say no. Like she said that she never does country songs because they're mostly acoustic and that doesn't offer enough variety in terms of like rhythm and instruments and all that. According to Melissa, the most fun kind of music for her to paint is funk. And I'm like, yeah, that's so much
fun. That would be so fun.
She and Questlove need to sit down.
Wow.
That could be such a fun collaboration.
Right? That could be the best collaboration.
So she said that funk music produces some of the most colorful compositions.
Nice.
Because of all the different rhythms and melodies and instruments. So you've got horns, you've got drums, you've got guitar, bass. And that it just creates this like beautiful saturated color effect that she's able to paint. According to her, guitars are generally golden and angled, and piano is more marbled and jerky because of the chords.
Ooh.
Yeah. If she paints the same song twice, it will still be somewhat unique, even though like a lot of the colors will be the same. And like, we'll post images of her work because it's really cool. Like, it's very, it's
gorgeous. It's, mm-hmm. And versatile.
Exactly.
They all look very different.
Right?
I feel like this could be a really good like introduction to abstract art for people who don't quite get it.
Because yeah.
The association of like, it's abstracted, but it's connected to like how she hears music. I think that could register to people who don't connect to abstract art.
I agree. Totally. It's abstracted, but it's representative.
Yes.
Totally. Because like, you know, you can see like the differences. She did one Join Repetition by Prince. So obviously I love that one. I love you, Prince. I miss you still. But that one has like so much energy,
mm-hmm.
and it even has the color purple in there.
It's very purpley. It's kind of got like Easter colors, but like set against black.
I love it.
So like, even if she listens to a song like that, like Join Repetition twice, it's gonna have some of that same energy and obviously some of the same colors, but she does a lot of like paint splatter and really like gestural brushwork. Like, it's very textured and kind of like she's just feeling it. So even though she's seen some of the same colors, she also can notice something new. Like, if she picks up a new bass line in a song that she hadn't noticed before, the composition is going to look different the second time she does it. So like, when you look at her painting of Join Repetition compared to Cello Suite Number 1 by Bach, they're so different because
this one's
such
so tranquil.
Songs. I know, right? And when you listen to that song, just kind of like, you can picture like the movement of the notes and this sort of sweeping and like ebbing and flowing melody, and that it makes sense to look at that.
It's like, it's tranquil, but it's also kind of heavy.
Oh, definitely.
Yes, right? Yeah. And it's not as many colors because there aren't as many instruments.
Mm-hmm.
She met another artist with synesthesia and they both painted Little Wing by Jimi Hendrix.
That's gotta be a good one.
If I didn't include it in our thing here, but we'll post the article, and it has a lot of different paintings that she's done, and they're so cool and they're so beautiful and vibrant and they're all really unique. But Little Wing by her version was a entirely different from this other artist.
That's awesome. I love it.
And she was just like, you know, that just goes to show how it's still very subjective.
Oh, yeah.
And that not all people with synesthesia see the same shit. They don't see the same colors relating to different sounds. Like, it's all very unique to that person.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think she's painting them while listening to the song?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, it doesn't say that explicitly in the article, mm-hmm. but definitely she has to do that in order to get the impression of the colors.
Yeah.
And she also has said that more than often she paints songs, but she did a painting for her mom based on the sounds of her mom's footsteps. Like, she has a memory of her mom's kind of like clacking shoe footsteps, and how that sound to her was this really beautiful, comforting purple.
Aww.
And so she made a painting based off of that. And like, I mean, I was thinking about that too, where it's like, if I had to assign a color of association to my mom, it would probably be purple.
I would say purple or blue.
Yeah.
To your mom.
Your mom's a purple vibe for sure.
She's got a very like,
you know, like matronly, but like sassy.
Yeah. But also kind of like tranquil.
I was going to say,
yeah.
Like sassy, but also comforting. Like sassy in the way that you know that she would use that sass to protect you from anything.
She's a total mama bear.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Can we talk about this Radiohead painting?
I love it.
I'm obsessed with it.
I knew you would want to.
Oh my God. I love it.
It's beautiful. And she has a couple that she did for Radiohead songs, but the one that Corey is talking about is Karma Police.
Oh, it's so
and
good.
It is just the most vibrant, just rich. And it's beautiful because the background are all these like really beautiful dark blues and like indigos and really, really dark colors. And then she has all these little like brush strokes that kind of come together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, it looks like a space scene, like from far away. But upon closer examination, it reminds me of like Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah,
like it just looks like there's something out of Alice in Wonderland.
Just so many colors and the way they overlap, and just the versatility in brush stroke, and like there's really a lot going on, but it does all like work cohesively somehow.
Yeah,
and that's such an amazing representation of Radiohead, because if you know anything about like Radiohead and Thom Yorke, and just from a like music theory standpoint, what they did for music was some of the most avant-garde shit. You know, they layered and created sounds. You know, they're studied in music theory courses, and for good reason, because they just have done some of the weirdest shit and then made it somehow work.
Right.
And this is such a perfect like visual representation of that, you know? Yes,
I agree.
It's so good.
Yeah. And just looking at the variety, because when you think about music, there obviously goes without saying so many different kinds of genres, but just how she renders all these, like from Bach to like Prince,
right?
And how they all are so unique, but they seem to fit. Like, I did a little experiment with myself where I went through this article and I went through all of the paintings that she did, and I listened to the songs while I was looking at them just to see if like, does this resonate with me?
Yeah, yeah.
And almost all of them did. And she does one, Life on Mars by David Bowie, and I watched the music video for it after I had like listened to it, looking at the painting, and even some of the colors that she uses in that match like his color palette in the music video, which I don't know if that was intentional or not, but like from his eyeshadow to his hair color to like how very pale he was, and all that comes through
in the painting.
In the painting, which is really interesting.
I feel like, I don't know, she's just kind of, I think we're all connecting to her because we're all obviously such visual people, but we're all huge music lovers too.
Exactly.
So it's like, that's your thing. She is really fun. Like,
Check her out. I really
love her
work. We'll post links to her, and I mean, I don't know what her going rate is, but like as soon as I have like a little time and like a little money, and just be like, hello, yeah, Musa.
Hello.
Will you make me, I don't even know who I would choose.
What,
like,
would I do?
You have to do Prince. Ooh, I know. I mean, Prince would certainly be the first, like the immediate one that comes to mind, but there's also like some other ones.
Yeah, what are some songs everyone would do?
I think I would do I Feel For You by Prince, because that's just like a fun, happy song. And I feel like it would be beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I just was listening to Gustav Holst's The Planets.
Mm.
It's a classical piece. Mm-hmm. I would want Mars. It'd probably be like really epic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'd want to see something really like, I feel like something connected to my childhood in some like really intense way. I feel like it'd be cool to see like some kind of like grunge, like alternative grunge song of some sort. Like, I would like to see what she would come up with for that.
I want Alice in Chains.
Alice in Chains would be great.
Yeah, girl.
Or Stone Temple Pilots.
Yeah.
That would be fun. Yeah. Oh, Stone Temple
Something
Pilots.
Grungy.
Fleetwood Mac would also be dope. That'd be a good one.
There's so many to choose from. It's gosh. So hard. Oh, follow me.
Also, I'm just out of curiosity, I'd like to see like Spice Girls or something.
You know,
that could be like a really fun thing, you know.
I think it would be fun and very
it's
colorful.
Just frantic,
like little splashes of color.
Yeah.
Spice up your life.
Spice it up. They're having a reunion. Have you seen this shit?
No, for real?
Oh, for real. It has been verified.
What?
The Spice
That's
Girls
awesome.
Are having a reunion.
What's Scary Spice been up to? She was my favorite.
I don't know, but they're all in. All five of them are
nice.
In.
Doesn't she host America's Got Talent?
What? I don't know. I don't watch TV.
No, isn't that Scary Spice? What was her name?
Really?
She was married to Eddie Murphy for
Melanie.
Bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was married to Eddie Murphy.
Mel B. She hosts this. My parents watch it.
Really?
Yeah. America's
That's
Got Talent.
Oh, okay.
She's precious. She's as precious as ever.
How did I not know she was married to Eddie Murphy?
Eddie Murphy used to live over here, you guys. Eddie Murphy lived in a neighborhood 10 minutes from here.
So, no. I know this is getting crazy.
What?
what is happening?
Wait. I know, but let me just say one thing.
Hit us.
My new boo.
Yeah.
He is from here, from the area, and he delivered pizza to Eddie Murphy's house one time when he was
Eddie,
a teenager.
Eddie Murphy lived in Sacramento?
In Granite Bay.
Yeah.
What? Like, how and why?
Because there's this really, really nice gated neighborhood, and
I don't know. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a weird house because it was actually for sale for a while and it like wasn't selling. It was in the market, like crashed. Really? And it was bizarre. There was like a lot of like black and white, like checkered and like really like, it was
interesting.
Yeah. But like kind of tacky. Wow. Yeah. Some of the pictures I saw, I just remember thinking like, that's tacky.
Hey, he's not coming up on her spouses.
Yeah. I don't think they're married.
I don't think they got married.
I thought that they...
I mean, did they date? I didn't know that. I just know that he lived here, and I know that she's on America's Got Talent.
Maybe they just dated for a bit, but I'm pretty sure
Spice Girls reunion.
That they were intimate at one point in time.
Okay. Well,
how did we get here?
I don't know.
You're right. From 2006 to 2007. Yes,
Vista Del Lago. That's it.
I know my shit. I know how we got there because we were talking about what song we would like.
Spice Girls.
Melissa to paint.
Yes.
And we said Spice Girls for fun. Nat, what would you like?
My gut is Bob Dylan.
Oh,
but yeah. I mean, I probably have a lot of brown tones just because of the
guitar.
That's
the thing. She would was saying, okay. But she said she wasn't crazy about the acoustic. So it'd have to be one of his more like varietal songs or the Avett Brothers, I think, would be great because they have their grunge background.
Some of
and
the stuff
yelling.
Like Kick Drum Heart. Kick Drum Heart would make a really good painting.
Exactly. I think some of the ones where they get really kind of like screamy and there's a lot of instruments going on be fantastic. Totally. So that would probably be my final answer.
Yeah.
Something of the Avett Brothers.
Nice.
Always. Yeah, so many possibilities.
Right? That's the beauty.
If only we could afford this.
I mean, I don't know.
It's probably a lot, dude.
But I feel like the knowledge of and appreciation for synesthesia is only going to grow. Mm-hmm. So then it's like the possibility that more people will realize they have it, maybe be interested in visual arts and maybe create things like this. And the art of synesthesia will grow. And be more
if
readily
you're
available.
Listening, and you know you have this, give painting a chance.
And if you want to, and if you want to practice and paint us some songs, we'd be stoked.
I also think just conceptually, I mean, like doing abstract paintings based on songs, like anyone can do that. Like you don't have to have synesthesia to try and represent how a song makes you feel visually.
And maybe
you
can even train yourself to.
Well,
have
and if Ginny's done, I can jump over to another possibility.
Oh, man, it's just gonna get crazier.
I know,
you guys.
This episode is so fucking.
That's
wild.
What I've been thinking this whole time. If I'm like, if we're jumping this far off from these topics,
we're about
like,
to jump
listeners. Buckle up for this shit.
This is really nice. This is really intense, like for real.
All right, guys. So
no pressure, Nat.
There's about to be some debate. So Neil Harbison, if you have not heard of him, he is a cyborg. He is officially considered a cyborg by the government of Britain, I want to say. It might be Spain because he was born in Britain but raised in Catalan. He's completely colorblind, so cannot see color whatsoever. At age 21, scientists installed a device in the back of his head. Installed a device in the back of his head which enables him to hear color. It's an electronic eye. He calls it an eyeborg.
Wow.
And it was designed by scientist Adam Montadon, which transposes the light frequencies of color hues into sound frequencies.
Wow.
So you can go back and listen to our color theory episode if you haven't already, because we delve a lot into how color is frequency, not actually something material.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can get more background on that. But yeah, so he's colorblind, but he hears colors thanks to this little eyeborg attached to his brain.
Eyeborg.
I know.
He's a little eyeborg.
He got a little eyeborg. It's very cute. It comes out like an antenna. It attaches to the back of his skull and reaches around, curves over the top of his skull into the front.
I don't know about cute, though.
I mean, I've been looking at it for a while, so I think it's kind of grown on me. Yeah.
People going to start making fashion statements with their eyeborgs, right? Like, decorating their eyeborgs.
And it truly moves like a little antenna. It has, what would that even be like? Like wires, I guess, in it that allow it to kind of like move around seamlessly.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He can like bend it and move it to face in different directions so he can like target things, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So weird.
Exactly. And so he considers this Electronic Eye or Eyeborg to be an extension of himself right. at this point.
Interesting.
He did not feel that way from the beginning. It's not like they attached it to him and he was right. like, oh my God, this is a part of my body.
Yeah. This is who I am
exactly.
now.
Exactly. I feel like it's almost like people, and I don't know how people exactly feel about prosthetics, but I'm guessing at a certain point of having a prosthetic and getting used to it, you do feel like it's an extension mm-hmm. of you. Mm-hmm. So he considered this to be part of himself when he started dreaming in color. So he decided that when he was dreaming the sounds of different colors, that that was his mind creating them, and it was no longer
when you become fluent in another language and you dream yeah. in that language.
Yeah, it's That's no longer the device creating these sounds. It's himself learning it's them.
Your brain learned it. That's like, that's really how you know you made it with a language is if you dream in a different language.
Exactly, exactly. So I felt like that was a very logical kind of association. Totally. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he does feel very, very strongly about this cyborg identity. A little background on him. He started art school before the Eyeborg was inserted. Okay. So he had dreams and aspirations of becoming an artist before he could see color. And he said he got to school and went straight to the dean's office, and they were basically, he was like, yeah, I can't see color, and they were like, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you here? And he pushed on, and they wouldn't let him, you know, paint in black and white or just purely work in black and white. They made him use color before he could conceive of it, but he got this implant at 21, and then it kind of just opened up everything. He says he would have been a concert pianist, or he thinks he would have been a concert pianist had he not had the implant. But
interesting.
Yeah. But also makes sense because it's this, like, sound was his way mm-hmm. of understanding art. Yeah. And now he can understand something that he could never conceive through sound. So yeah. it's just like. Yeah.
So I just Googled Eyeborg and because I'm so curious now. And instead of your boy, I'm getting this other man by the name of Rob Spence, a 37-year-old Canadian filmmaker who sustained permanent damage to his right eye when he was 9. And in 2009, he had an eye camera, like a camera installed well, that's in what his this eyeball.
Is. This is a camera. It's just he already has two eyes, so it comes over the top instead of being...
So it's not in his eye.
It's not in his eye, but it works as an eye.
Oh,
it's an still, extra eye.
It's an extra
so
eye, and that's
wild.
Yeah. So it's just, it's instead of it being a replacement for an eye, it's an additional eye.
So he has a third eye.
Yes.
Literally.
Wow.
Not just in the like he's spiritual not, woke sense. Like he
literally
he's
has a third
literally
eye.
Literally woke. that is so, so wild.
He has been artificially woke.
And I want to just ask really quick, when you were researching Neil.
Yes.
How did he come about the Eyeborg? How did he get that procedure done? Who did it? Did he have to
Well,
pay?
I already mentioned Adam Montadon was the scientist who did it, and I forget exactly which institution he okay. is
so
connected
maybe it
to.
Was like experimental though, like so he did he
yeah it started out okay. as something a lot more clunky, I think, as most things like this do, where it involved wow. headphones and like an external pack mm-hmm. and then it evolved to what it is now, which is actually attached to his brain and
oh
coming out
God.
The top.
That is
and,
so
yeah
wild.
Just to like impress, like, so he obviously considers this to be like a part of his identity. He battled with the passport people to take his photo.
The passport people.
Passport people. Yeah, he like vehemently argued that he should be allowed to take his passport photo with his yeah. antenna, and that's why he is actually like considered a cyborg by the government, because he had to like assert wow. and prove that he is a cyborg in order to be one in his passport. he believes
wow.
very strongly in this.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and there was apparently, so there were protests in Spain, I think in Barcelona, that he attended, and because his Eyeborg is like a camera, police were like telling him like, shut that down, take it off, and he was like, I can't, it's literally like a part of me. Mm-hmm. And they like, I don't know exactly how it transpired, but they made him take it off, or like took it off of him forcefully. And so he like went home with like exposed wires and stuff. And he describes it as the worst day of his life. Like, which,
that's
you know,
awful.
Like all of this, like, you know,
oh
it's
God.
There's a lot of things going on here and like feelings about like what's like legitimate and what's kind of, I don't know. It's complicated. But that in itself, I felt like was horrifying.
Yes.
Like that sounds truly just traumatizing. Whatever you believe about this, that seems like an assault on
totally.
His rights. But just in general, very cool. He says he can listen to a Picasso, which is just a nice. Cool thing to be able to say. Says he used to wear what looked good and now he wears what sounds good.
Oh, I like
so
that.
So he can, wow. you know, he That's knows nice. Like which notes are like happy and he has like notes that he'll wear to a funeral because they're somber to him. So even though it may not be black to him, it all so cool. associates. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And in 2010, he co-founded the Cyborg Foundation with Moon Rebus, who is another cyborg artist, which is an international organization that aims to help humans become cyborgs, defend cyborg rights, and promote cyborg art. They have a website. We will post it with our sources.
Wow.
So
is the one named Moon?
She's the one, yeah.
That can feel earthquakes on the moon. Mm-hmm.
So she had...
I get it now.
She had devices attached to her feet, and she can feel vibrations coming from the earth, and she can feel earthquakes, and she says she can also feel moonquakes.
Whoa.
And I haven't looked too far into her
that
stuff.
That sounds
but
amazing.
I can't even imagine. Right? I can't even fathom.
I already feel like I am... super sensitive to the moon. Like, I can't imagine what having that like physical,
I know,
like actual physical relationship, but right. like it's already bad enough with right. all the emotions.
Like, I feel like 10 minutes in they could talk you into getting these devices.
I know.
Corey.
I feel like I'd be like yes.
I wonder
do
if,
it.
if she's been like accosted by those hollow moon conspiracy theorists. You know,
we could ask her.
I know.
That would be a great like forum, like the person hollow moon theorist versus the person that can literally feel earthquakes on
no,
the moon.
No, it's literally versus moon because yeah. her name is Moon Rebus.
Yeah. Hollow moon theorist versus
moon.
Moon.
But that's Whoa. So. I would love to talk to her. Like mm-hmm. that is such
I
a
just
dope.
I want to know what that feels like.
Yeah, it's such mm-hmm. a baller move. Like such a cool way to live your
just
life.
What a trip that would be to be like in the fucking chip aisle of the grocery store, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you. Feel a moonquake
and your feet are just like
how vibrating. How do you find that balance?
I just don't know if I would want it in my feet, you know, because I would just feel like I was gonna fall down all the time. Yeah. And I already do
Who
feel
knows
like
what
that.
It actually feels like
you fall in
maybe we'll do a full episode on Moon Rebus. Maybe we can look into
yeah,
this.
Because who knows what it actually like, yeah. All we know is that she feels it. We don't know that she feels it like an earthquake.
Yeah.
You right. know, who knows how she actually feels yeah. it, you know?
Yeah.
Wild.
Like, because it could just be a sensation that runs through her body or something.
Life is so crazy.
I know. I love it so much. damn. Synesthesia.
What a crazy episode.
What a roller coaster.
I know.
Hey, I'm still going.
I feel, you got more
Oh,
for
my
us?
God. Yes. Yeah. Yes, yes,
Tell
yes.
us about more cyborgs.
Oh, I just haven't gotten to his art yet.
Oh, yeah.
There's art. So,
an art podcast.
A secondary effect of hearing color is color perception. So he describes it as radios are no longer in black and white. Radios are in color. So every sound has a color. So it works both ways. So he'll paint songs that he likes in the same way that
Melissa
mm-hmm. worked, but they look very, very different. Jenny and yeah. I were comparing earlier. I threw them in the notes if you guys want to take a look. They're very geometric.
They're just they're not expressionist.
No, not at all.
Are. They're yeah.
It's much more scientific, which makes sense.
They almost
he's
they're
a cyborg.
Exactly. They look computer generated.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they look really amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they're beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and I put on that. There's a visualization of Beethoven's Fur Elise, and there's a visualization of Amy Winehouse's Rehab. Mm. And he also works in the opposite way. Most of his work works in the opposite way, which transports colors into sound. So he'll do facial portraits where mm-hmm. you can hear someone's face. So he created these for Prince Charles, James Cameron, Tracy Emin, Al Gore. He did for Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise.
Gore. Wow.
Al Gore's was very pleasant. That was the one actually that I found the most like kind of calming. He's also done speeches. He painted a speech from Hitler and one from from Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
and had people try and guess which was which. And he said most of the time people got it wrong. And I didn't
That's
see these two paintings.
Really interesting.
Isn't it?
Ooh.
I know.
That is so fascinating.
I know. Huh. But I also like just kind of wanted to ask you guys what you thought. Like, is this synesthesia? Is it synthetic synesthesia?
Yeah, I think it's induced synesthesia. I mean, obviously, he doesn't have the genetic type for it. It's not. But I do think it's an artificial version.
Yeah, and I wonder about how he does the paintings, because did he have anything installed into his eye? Because according to just what is said about him, like, his color blindness is so intense that he really sees in grayscale, right?
Yeah, everything he sees is in grayscale, but I mean, he can read, so like, you could know which tubes of paint are colors. Right. It's like, before that, he would have just had to memorize, like, this color is used for this thing, and now he can associate these words for colors to sounds that he hears. So the visual color is still completely absent. Like, he doesn't know what that looks like, but he can still create it based on what he's hearing.
So he's basically his artificial synesthesia is actually a connection between its phonemes and sounds. So he's connecting words with sounds, and the product is visual. Because that's what he's doing in his brain, is connecting what a color is, the word of the color, with a sound.
Yes.
And so his artificial synesthesia actually has nothing to do with color. It has to do with phonemes, but he's creating something that's colored. So I still think it's artificial synesthesia, but it's actually not color to music. It's word to music.
That we get to experience as color.
We get to see it.
But for him, the color, like,
that
the
we
actual
get to see the color
is completely left out. And he doesn't always work in color. Like, those paintings, I think, are some of the more, like, that stuff he does, just to branch out a little, a lot more of what he does is in sound, because that's what he can experience.
Blowing my damn mind.
Yeah. I think that's even better, because it's almost like a different form of synesthesia for the creator and the viewer. Like, it's representing two different things, which I am super about. I like it a lot. Very interesting.
God. Yeah, that's Neil Harbison.
The more I look at his paintings and thinking about it that way, that makes a lot of sense, because it does feel like you're traveling through a song.
Yeah.
And it's the change in, you know, the music, as though you're like going down this tunnel and you're traveling through a song.
Reminds me of that movie, The Animatrix.
Ooh.
If y'all have never seen it.
I've seen The Matrix.
Watch The Animatrix. It's also like really disturbing and scary, so just know that it's very scary.
Just wow.
Science is just amazing, and
life is just amazing.
I'm just blown away.
I know, right? This stuff is so cool, and I
want to know everything about this guy.
If you're more interested in him too, I'll post. There's a 5-minute short called Hearing Colors that's on Vimeo that you can watch. He does a TED talk. A TED Radio Hour episode where they, you know, do clips of the TED talk, but he also interviews with Guy Raz. There's a lot of stuff out there. He's very, very vocal. He's written some essays, just discussing all of these things that he's so passionate about, like cyborg rights and hearing color and why people should be cyborgs. He really wants
what a fucking fascinating person
to bring in more cyborgs. Yeah. So there's a lot of resources out there if you're interested in him. He's there. He's out there, and he's wearing crazy colors, and he's being himself.
Wow, he looks very stylish.
He does.
Yeah, that's styling.
I like that color combination. He looks like a hip Ken doll.
The pants. Oh,
primary colors all around.
Wow.
Wowie. Synesthesia. This is just such an interesting topic, and I'm really fascinated to just even see the development, because I feel like we're just at the forefront of what this even means and what we can do with it, you know, and especially now that you bring in like all of the science and the technological, the idea of like induced synesthesia. I am really excited to see the future of art related to synesthesia, because I feel like it's just this whole new realm of perception and the way we connect art and the arts, because I think just like the connection between the visual and music is huge, like it's such a big thing. And yeah, it's super fucking cool. So
exciting.
Agree.
Yeah. If you are either interested in this topic, or if you have synesthesia, if we have any listeners with it, please write us in and tell us about your experiences. We'd love to hear them. Yeah. Or if you know about more artists that work with it, that would be great too. Anything you might want to add to the conversation, this obviously can go on into many different directions.
Share
with us,
please.
Speaking of sharing, quick listener mail. This comes to us from our girl Nora. The subject is, oh hell yes,
nice.
First of all, thank you Thank you for giving me something fascinating, educational, hilarious, and intelligent to listen to. I have a BA in art history and freaking love listening to a coven of women who love art history and wine as much as I do.
Yeah.
Love it. I haven't listened to an episode yet where I haven't been stirred with emotion about how much I love art, how important it is, and how I'm so happy I studied it, even though I work in a different field now. In my undergrad, I took a course on advertising, a wild and crazy ride filled with art historical references, contemporary visual culture, sexism, manipulation, drama, etc., etc. I'm sure you all have studied it. Have you thought of doing an episode about that subject? I think it could be oh so cool, and you all would shine some great light on it. Anyway, keep it up. Love it every minute, and hopefully run into you at a Bay Area museum someday.
Chances are
they're good. Yeah. They're high.
I actually was there. Would like to perhaps in the next year try and do like a Bay Area meetup for our listeners, because I think, I mean, that's obviously the easiest one for us to do. I think that could be fun. So if that's something you're interested in, definitely contact us in some way, because the more interest we have, the more likely we are to do it.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah, pretty much. So that could be a fun thing. Bay Area Art History Babe Day. But advertising, yes.
Yeah.
I could get behind definitely one of those episodes for sure. And I feel like I don't know. I feel like it'd be hard to keep it to one episode.
Oh yeah, there's so many angles.
It would turn into like
there's so many angles.
Part three, part six, not
especially like dependent on period and all that. Because when I wrote that blog post of opening title sequences, and I was reading all about the artist that made the opening sequence for Mad Men, and how they were looking at all these advertisements from the 60s, and that's when like advertising was really in its like burgeoning golden era, and just the kind of things that were being conveyed in advertisements and the way that they were being portrayed is really interesting. I also think I was looking on our list of episode ideas, and I think I put this on there where it was poster advertisements against venereal disease during like in the 40s.
You did put those on there. Well, those are cool.
And that definitely, I mean, that's, you're now, we're diving into the world of like propaganda, which is something else we want to talk about.
And, and a lot of times too, like advertisement and propaganda, they cross over in weird ways.
And I definitely want to do that.
It's
episode
a great topic.
We talked about in Weird Pootie, we talked about the soap advertisements that are very fascinating. I TA'd for a gender in contemporary like visual media class, where we looked at a lot, it was more of like a feminist, like looking at depictions of mostly women in advertisement throughout, like we really focused more on like the 90s and stuff, but like seeing how women have been portrayed in advertisements and in music videos and stuff. So that's like a whole nother angle, like we could do a whole episode on that easily. There's so many angles to the advertisement thing, and I agree it's stupid important, because like that is like the visual material people are being bombarded with all the time. So look forward to, I think, multiple future episodes on that, because we have angles from
many different
1800s, 1900s, you know, like we have there's so many. Advertisement is such a clear example of what is happening to a culture at the time, you know.
Absolutely.
When you really look into basically what people are trying to sell, you learn a lot about a culture. So great suggestion. We'll add it to the never-ending list of episodes, but we are keeping track of them now.
We are,
and we are making our way through them, so if you give us suggestions, it goes on the list. But thank you so much, Nora. We appreciate your message and your ideas. Thank you to everyone listening. Be sure to check out our newly revamped website.
It's beautiful.
Arthistorybabes.com. We have...
It looks great.
We have so much new stuff. We have so many new blog posts. We've got great new merch. Some of it limited time only. So get on it. Check it out. Yeah. Just like cool things to look into. Also, our YouTube channel is... We're right on the edge of like getting that popping. It does exist. So you can subscribe to us right now. There isn't a lot on it, but you can subscribe to it. We're actually doing a lot of filming right now at this very... date and time, so get on our YouTube, because that'll be fun too. All kinds of fun things.
So many fun things.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Bye.
From Cabernet to Mont-Lane, they're here to slay the art history babes, go to a pumpkin fest.
All right, listeners, if you know of pumpkin fests that are, you know, renowned, let us know.
Yeah.
We want to know.
We'll shed an art historical eye on pumpkin carving.
Right.
The Art History Babes podcast is made possible by support from our lovely listeners via Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes to help keep the Art History Babes going and for access to bonus content.